The Ocelli Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck Ocelli.
February 9, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this indeed is the show you were looking for. How do I know this? Well, you can hear me bang on my mic stand. Anyway, there's a weird reason why I do that at the beginning of the show every day, but I probably won't tell you about it. It is Wednesday, Woden's Day, the middle of the week. And if you're on the live stream, we started late. If you're on the podcast, you don't care. You started it when you started it. So no matter where you are, who you are, when you are, even if you're catching us further on down the stream via your fondle slab of choice, your applicable application, your podcatcher du jour, we welcome you to Wednesday on the Ocelli Effect. So, a voice which I am all too familiar with and most listeners at Ocelli.com are familiar with. Gotta say, he hasn't been on the Ocelli Effect in a while. He's an author, a podcaster, a broadcaster, and a documentary filmmaker, plus kind of just a sort of a weird performance artist one way or another. Who am I talking about? Aaron Franz, the author of Revolve, Man's Scientific Rise to Godhood, and the guy behind, The Age of Transitions. That is a documentary, but it's also a radio show on Ocelli.com, and the co-host of Uncle, either the broadcast if you're hearing it live, or Uncle the Podcast if you're hearing it via podcast, which I joined when it was already in progress, but now as a live show functions a little differently because he takes calls and all that good stuff. And if you listen to Ocelli.com, you can catch that show live 10 p.m. to midnight Eastern, almost any week because Aaron doesn't take too many off all the time. And you can call in and join in to both shows. So it's like 1 hour of Aaron's show, which Uncle calls the government hour, and 1 hour of the Uncle show where I am just the co-host, Aaron says. Here is the star of the show, Uncle. And we go into Uncle's world for an hour. Can I describe it here? No, because I've only got an hour with Aaron Franz. Anyways, it is what it is. How do you like that intro, Aaron? Is that working for you?
Yeah, that's accurate. I like it. And yeah, it's great to be back here, Chuck, on Odin's Day. This feels good to be doing this again. It's been a long time, as you said.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm going to go right into your wheelhouse tonight because I've tried to discuss transhumanism with people, and it is not merely the, Luddite, knee-jerk, reactionary sort of thing that some people think it is, where it's like, you're afraid of technology, aren't you? Isn't technology good? Technology is going to do good things for people. Well, on the one hand, I agree. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I'm also cautious because man's scientific rise to godhood, there's a lot in that loaded statement, that being the subtitle of your book. Okay. And there's a lot to this. And I have remarked over the years to many people that you are one of the most interesting commentators on this because the excited utterance of just resistance outright is not necessarily what you do. You don't say, look, we should be afraid because this is against God's plan. And you don't necessarily do that. And you also don't say, let's embrace it all. You're not Rachel Haywire, after all, who is an interesting character. And if you don't know who I'm talking about there, ran in the 2020 presidential election under the party that is pro-transhumanism. Mm-hmm. If you don't believe me, look it up. It's a real thing. And she was a guest on your show. Mm-hmm. I think she was a guest on my show separately. I stole her from you because she was just that fascinating. But a lot of stuff you've covered about this and gone into, and you and I have had many a discussion now about an interesting character named Martine Rothblatt, who is transsexual, transhuman. Wait a minute, is transsexual a proper term anymore? Transgender, sorry. And all that. I mean, there is a whole wide world of this stuff from Criswell to comic books that is really, really out there. But anyway, Aaron, enough out of me. Let's get into the transhumanism aspect of it. And let me ask you questions that I might have asked you before, but let's do it again. How did you even get interested in the topic itself to begin with?
Well, I stumbled on it I just kind of came across it. Sound familiar when I saw it, but as it does, I mean, we've seen these ideas mainly in, throughout popular fiction, really. I mean, all the ideas of transhumanism really come right out of that, and it's the idea of making them a reality, making the science fiction reality. But I came across it because I was waking up, or whatever you call it. I was in a 9/11 truth group in Columbus, Ohio, so I was doing that. I was going through whatever changes are involved in that, which it brought about quite a number of them, actually, personally for me, mostly for the better, honestly, which is doesn't always end up that way from what I can tell. But for me, it did, and I'm really happy to have the experience of that. But so needless to say, I was reading about fringe topics, alternative takes on current events, and everybody is aware of that. Everybody listening to this show understands that. So that's where my headspace was. And then, you know, as part of my digging around and looking at stuff online, I came across the transhumanism Wikipedia page.
Okay, now before we go to that, okay, let's just add in a little bit of texture. You were the type of guy who was literally physically involved with a 9/11 truth group. And what do I mean by that? You know, you were out there on the streets actually handing out DVDs, which you and I have commiserated about doing that at a certain point when we could buy them for a dollar a piece. So we were making copies of things like Loose Change or whatever to just try and get it out to people, get them to consider the thoughts. Is it just stumbling on that Wikipedia page, or is it possible that you had stumbled across maybe somebody else's DVD that either touched upon this or focused on it that got you thinking before you went to the Wikipedia page? Because that sounds like what it could be, but I don't think I've ever asked you about this specifically. So it was that part of the process as well.
I think the only person that I had heard even mention it was Alan Watt. And I can't remember if I had heard him mention it a little before I came across the Wikipedia page, or kind of like just after or just as. But he's the only one I ever remember like talking about the topic in this regard, the regard that I was the point of view I was coming at it from, really, was what he was doing. So he's the only one I remember even doing that. So I know that he was an influence there, but I also kind of felt like I felt a little bit of a kinship with Alan Watt, actually, in that just I felt like I was kind of doing the same thing, and we were working along the same lines, for what that's worth. I'm sure I'll draw criticism from some for that. And
well, whatever, but there's that combined with, let's just, you know, again, cut to the chase, a little bit of what I like to call geekdom, where, you know, you get interested in sci-fi, you get interested in forms of entertainment, maybe you find a place among the gamer community as it used to stand, or you wind up in the tabletop gaming, sphere, something like this. The ideas that some of this conspiracy stuff blended with the fictional constructs, which are either later on reproduced, in Hollywood and then in real life, or are the inspirations, you know, did the people who wrote, the Star Trek stuff, like Gene Roddenberry is an amazing universe unto himself. Did he picture certain things before they happened, or was he informed? You know, and these kind of things have kicked around as just sort of general topics of discussion. Again, if you were one of these people that maybe was interested in the sci-fi, fantasy, general genre, and maybe got, a bit more intensely into it than, well, I'll go see a movie if it comes out. Did that have something to do with this also, I'm wondering?
Yeah, well, yeah, sure. I mean, I've always enjoyed sci-fi. It's probably my favorite genre of film, and, you know, always a fan of movies like Terminator movies and things like that, Terminator 1 and 2, certainly. And I mean, all sorts of other sci-fi, too. Even when I was a kid in middle school, I loved the Aliens movie, the sequel to Alien. And yeah, I just, you know, I love that sort of thing. And of course, growing up when I did, there's so much stuff just throughout the media about these ideas. So, of course, that influenced me. There's no doubt about that.
Well, and how old were you when, say, like The Matrix came out?
Was that 96?
I think it was 99.
99. Okay, I was basically just graduated high school. Yeah, more or less.
Okay, fair enough. So that makes you, you know, about 9 years younger than me, which makes sense. Okay, so you wait a minute. You're coming up on 40 then, huh?
No, I'm past 40. Yeah, I'm 41 now, Chuck. Yeah.
Oh, you're 41. I lose track of everybody's age. Don't be offended at all.
Yeah, no, I'm not. I get that.
No, it's cool. I've worked with you for years, so it could be that at some point I had this idea that you're in your late 30s, and I just never updated the file in my brain. So it's okay. And I do know you're younger than me, not by a lot, but by just enough to sort of create an almost cultural divide, which is why I'm asking these questions. See, if you're coming out of high school and The Matrix came out, this started a whole new discussion as well in pop culture circles and in polite society, I even think, where, you know, there was the esoteric blending together with the technological aspects of possibilities and things. And this did create a discussion. But again, there's another side to this outside of entertainment. So I was just curious about what sort of factor that was for you, and it would be relevant.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you were like me in the 70s looking at, you know, Star Trek reruns while sitting on your grandmother's floor with the big, you know, console TV, you had to use a little more of your imagination, you know what I mean, to get to some of the concepts. But it became more visually accessible and informationally accessible again in the late 90s, you know, advent of the internet for the public, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, I digress. Let's get back to your story on this, because I want to go past your awareness of it at first. And why? Let me just give you the spoiler for the whole point of the conversation. As of late, I've decided that people are having less of a reaction to this than I thought they were a few years ago. Now, I don't like to encourage panic or fear. It's not what I'm about ever. But there were people that were generally fearful of things like robo-bees and, you know, and oh, they're going to have technologies that are going to allow them to spy on us even better. That was only a few years ago, and now it's almost like a given. Mm-hmm. And when you try and talk to people about things like the singularity, which I brought up to somebody the other night on my show, they almost dismissed it. Like, no, they're not going to be able to upload the human mind into, you know, a computer. That's impossible. you know, stuff like this. Like, some people actually think that what they see in the public domain, as far as what's accessible to us, really represents as far as technology has gone. And it's been proven time and time again that that is not the case. You know, in the hands of DARPA, in the hands of certain agencies, in the hands of private industry, well, maybe private industry, that exists in the technosphere, there's always many, many generations ahead being tested, being utilized, but maybe not accessible to the whole of the public. And this is something that we've seen proven over and over again. So for people that think, well, the computer's not really capable of uploading my entire consciousness, one, first of all, do you think that it's meant to upload your entire consciousness? Two, I'm not talking about the thing sitting on your desk. I'm not talking about the phone in your pocket, which, you know, is more powerful than the thing that used to be sitting on your desk only a short time ago. But there is something far outside of this with the quantum computing and the imaginations of the very intelligent people like Rothblatt, who I brought up, who is one of the most remarkable people I've ever been able to study from a distance. As far as the diversity of skills and the level of intellect that may be truly involved in advancing the technology. So, but the thing is, a lot of people are not fearful of it now. A lot of people think, well, no, that's just silliness and science fiction. But they do that all the way up until the witchcraft happens, where you can talk to somebody without a wire. where you can, see things from around the world instantly, which it was like, well, how in the world are you ever going to do that? It's obviously going to take time to move an image or to broadcast or, yeah, not so much anymore. And even with the toys we have in the public domain, we can do this. So imagine what the best stuff really looks like again and again. But I find the attitude shifting, and at the same time, a more intense interest has grown among maybe the people that would typically ask questions anyway. So I throw all of that on the table for you, Mr. Franz, because I know you're capable of handling it all. So by all means, I'll shut up now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people certainly are not – they don't seem to be talking about things as they were, like you're pointing out there, Chuck. And I think the reason for that is pretty simple. We have so many other like news items that we get distracted with that I think are, for the most part, quite frankly, a waste of time. So many things that we get up in arms about and so much debate. I get sick and tired of that real quick. But, I mean, the same people making hay about all the dumbest stuff now will be the ones that are the loudest when these things actually get developed as they get developed and they see that it is an actual, they will claim it is the ultimate threat against, I don't know, their God or their idea of what society should be or whatever it is that drives them. They'll be the loudest to do that, and they'll have a giant crowd of reactionary nincompoops who listen to them and believe them. And it'll do more harm than good, but I mean, what else is new? That's just the way that goes. But I mean, with the computing power, it's interesting. The computing power that would be necessary to do things like the mind uploads or the advanced metaverse things where it is powered by very sophisticated machine learning AI systems that require like massive computing power just to work. We're finding now that there's a lot of developments that are really almost like transhumanism in reverse, at least in terms of like the popular idea. So when you think of transhumanism, it's the idea of like integrating the machine into the human being. It's like, oh, I'm going to take a computer chip and put it in my brain to advance me. I'm going to, you know, do some sort of gene therapy to, I don't know, just extend my life or whatever. So it's taking the technology and putting it into the human biology. The reverse is happening too, where actual information technology is being created biologically now. So they're like using all sorts of I forget all the details of this, but basically these like cellular computers, like actual like living biological cells they're using to do like computing and things like that. So, this goes all different directions. We could get, I think by the time, you know, the quantum computing and just the kind of processing power that would be necessary to even think about conscious machines, right? Whatever that even means. Like, if you actually want to realize that, and when it could be, I think that you're going to see more and more of these like weird biological information technologies popping up, and the idea of the converging technologies, the information technology, biotech, nanotech, the report that I referenced back on the Age of Transitions video, that's what that was all about. The main idea of that report, that government report they did, was that, hey, look, there's these four sectors of emerging technologies, and the way we really want to leverage them is by overlapping. So you get advances in AI through advances in biotech, information technology, and cognitive science. The cognitive science is where, and really you could say, well, if we've created a thinking computer, that's cognitive science, because it's the machine now has cognition. So I don't know. That's the way I I've had lots of thoughts also on the esoteric side of this. It was bouncing all through my head today, actually, and that people will just not see the esoteric side of this. And I don't think, I mean, that's not about to happen, that people like really see, or let alone they're definitely not going to understand the esoteric side of this, which is very important, very real. But I mean, being anything meaningful in the esoteric sphere is, it's difficult to pin down, and people want to immediately throw all sorts of their own biases on top of all of that, which becomes a problem real fast. And I don't know what's going on.
Well, especially for the neophyte kind of issues here, because if this is very suddenly introduced to someone's thoughts when it comes to, you know, any sort of debate or whatever, they often have a very serious based reaction in something that has more to do with their own prejudices than anything. As opposed to looking at the total picture, which is why, believe it or not, I'll reference Star Trek with you a lot. you know, if you take a look at the new show Discovery, you actually have visualizations of all of the back and forths you just talked about here, one way or another in the new series. And Star Trek has done that ahead of time, all the time, before we see a lot of technologies. And like I said, there's the debate as to whether it was encouraged, or is it the nerds that watched Star Trek that decided to go create the flip phones, you know, so on and so forth, one way or the other. But it's very interesting because it does make it a lot more palatable in an entertainment, in a fictional construct. But you can literally see how, okay, here's organic AI, basically. Which is, sounds like a strange term, but I mean, you literally have resurrections of individuals by using an organic base and literally melding it all together. You have the more sloppy constructs of, like, say, the Borg earlier on. You have the question of just self-awareness via the character of Data throughout the series. You have a lot of things that have gone on, you know, throughout the really 60-year-long journey with Star Trek, where all of these things have been gradually introduced into that universe in order for people to begin to even visualize some of these things and to contend with the implications of it from a moral standpoint, from a societal standpoint, from a, you know, well, how would this really work? Well, is the, you know, I mean, literally, a spoiler for anybody who hasn't seen Discovery this year, you know, at a certain point, the ship becomes self-aware, you know, which is a whole issue that they got to deal with now. Now that you're self-aware, can we even figure out where your loyalties are? You know, things like this, which is usually where people go, because, I mean, you know, again, it's an evolution as it's been introduced through pop culture, for sure. And as technology has become more readily available, I mean, again, if you were to take the cell phone and make it functional in some way and bring it back to, I don't know, 1822, you'd be a witch. You're talking to people somewhere else that are not here. Well, obviously, you know, you have conjured spirits. These are not, you know, this is evil that you're able to do this. And yet this is commonplace technology currently. And still, it does not represent the cutting edge. It just represents what is available in a proprietary sense for retail sale. You know, it doesn't mean that it represents anything about where it is we can go. I mean, even the GPS systems that people consider are, you know, kind of fairly somewhat new in the evolution of technology. Well, realistically, that stuff was available many years ago, but for military use. And by the way, so was the internet. You know, long before you and I got to play with HTML codes and things like that in the late 90s, it was available for what? Logistical purposes for the military, and communications for the military. So, I mean, there is a whole huge range of this stuff where it could be fearful to some people, and it could be absolutely terrifying, or the literal signaling of the grand apocalypse, no matter what your religious persuasion is. So, I mean, there's a lot of directions this can go in, and it's really one of the most endlessly available topics, and yet I find it to be odd with its trends about how people are interpreting it. If you asked me this 10 years ago, I would say that people were in terror in some segments of our society over the technological advances and the possibilities, and they were in fear of things that really weren't even all that threatening to them. You know, I bring up the RoboBees because I remember having to listen to and read tons and tons of stuff about people being afraid of the RoboBees. You know what I'm talking about? These little tiny.
Yeah. They've done lots of things with insects. They've emulated insects as robots. They've controlled insects with chips. So they've done all sorts of stuff like that. But yeah, I kind of remember those stories.
Hmm. And then there is the concept of the intangible, right? Because even, again, Star Trek reference, when you take a look at, well, we beam somebody, we transfer, what, matter into energy, and then reconstruct it on the other side of a transmitter. Is that a reformed copy of the individual and therefore not the individual from day one? Or, you know, because they beam themselves around 80, 90, 100 times, right? You know, did they actually die and were reformed again and again and again and unaware that they are not actually the original that the copy was made from? And this also gets into cloning and genetic manipulation. And I mean, there's just so much to cover. How the hell is it that you even put, you know, what you did into one book, really, when you wrote Revolver? I would have endlessly not known where to stop writing with that book. So, I mean, what do you got to say about that?
Well, I guess a criticism of the book could be that's a bit all over the place, but I try not to be. It's kind of like divided into two halves, the first half being more matter of fact, like, okay, this is the different transhuman projects, and these are technologies that are real. Here's people that have talked about it. Here's, you know, what's going on in there. And the second half I dedicate to the esoteric side of it. Well, here's the interesting esoteric religious occult side of the whole thing, as far as I'm concerned. And so I don't know. I if I wrote another book, I was thinking today, even like another book that would be good to write is just trying to explain how practical esoteric and occult concepts are, how they apply to technology, how technology has, you know, there's definitely philosophical underpinnings and philosophical ideas we attach to our, you know, the great social project that is science and technology, because we certainly attach a philosophy to it. I don't know how you could argue that. I don't think it's argued so much as just ignored. And we want to believe that science is like this completely objective thing that exists on its own, and oh, why bother talking about philosophy? I mean, that could be like a fun, weird doctoral thesis or something, but who cares about that stuff? That stuff doesn't matter in the real world anyway. So that's the thing. Like, there is definitely, I mean, there's a reason that we do things, and even even when there's reasons that we do things, and then there's explanations that we give and rationalizations that we give that we want to believe are the reasons that we're doing things. So it's this weird sort of gray space where I think there's like a transcendent reason that nobody's really going to articulate properly. And that's the realm of the esoteric. You have to kind of like go there to even like get close to that, to even understand what's actually going on. But I mean, we the human beings are typically in that realm of, well, what's our justification for whatever it is we think we're doing at the moment? And I mean, it's not, I don't know. I'm not, That's just how things kind of are for us. It's not even like a judgment call necessarily. It's just our situation, our predicament.
Self-propelled dialogue on this. I would call it Nimrods. And why would I call it? I'm literally offering this to you as the title of that book, right? Nimrods: How Man Has Confounded Themselves Against Themselves. And that would be a provocative title.
Yeah, I like that. That's good.
Why do I mention that? Because obviously the biblical story with Nimrod, who fired his bow into the air, and then God decided, you know what, I'll stop letting you guys communicate with each other, which is a very interesting metaphoric sort of way to begin to have that self-contained dialogue, because obviously you're going to have to go from more than one perspective to cover something like that. But there you go. And in the end, can anybody actually communicate with one another about this? I just offer it as an idea, Aaron. It was poked by you. So let's go into this. I mean, since you want to go esoteric and everything, there's a lot of ways to go here. And I like the fact that you're constantly in the business of making sure that, like, look, I'm not going to marry myself to the emotional response necessarily. Let me consider, all of what is available here. And I like that about your show, even, which you do quite often. Sometimes just a sort of dialogue with yourself, again, on Friday nights, where you just go, you know, I'm going to kick around this idea. And on the one hand, I see this. On the other hand, I see that. And it makes you question this universally, and maybe some people will agree with me, maybe not. And you'll do that, like, thinking out loud on your show for an hour. And it's great. I really appreciate it, because it's almost like I'm getting into the mind of an individual who has actually considered all this, an hour at a time. So I don't know. I really look forward to what it is you're going to produce in the future, and I'm also happy to produce you on Friday nights here on the network. But anyway. And we will give you the website to go take a look at Aaron's work and everything, which he does during his show all the time. But hey, look, it's been a while since you heard him on the Ocelli Effect. So it's a good idea to remind you about theageoftransitions.com and also UncleThePodcast.com, which before we get out of here, I'm going to ask you a little question or two about Uncle, but not yet. Because it is one of the most often had conversations as a producer and as somebody who has done this and very happily and proudly worked with you for, I don't know, how long has it been? 3 years now?
Oof, yeah, that is a good question. I am terrible at keeping track of chronology. Yeah, you and I both are like that. I want to say when would it have been? I'm trying to remember where we were living when we started, if we were here in Riverside or if we were in Orange. Do you remember where we said we were living when we started?
I can't. I really try. I know that you were in the closet at one point. I know that, you had done a special thing and brought it into the garage at one point. And then, of course, there's the New Year's Revolution, which is funny because it's really a misstatement of resolution with Uncle, but it's become Uncle's New Year's Revolution, which is a whole separate thing unto itself that we do for like 4 hours. And we've done a few of those, too.
Oh, yeah.
So I know it's been some years. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I've been proud and happy the whole time to do it because it is a unique experience every single Friday night. And I love it. But anyways. The thing is, though, that a lot of your shows, when you don't have guests and stuff, and even when you don't take callers, you have this sort of extemporaneous kind of stream of consciousness which comes out about some of these topics. Occasionally you've covered politics, but politics is not really your wheelhouse. It's usually about the philosophical and the very curious stuff that technology does and what the results of it are and what the sociological impact of many events and trends are. So I love the fact that it's always like that every Friday night, though, because you never quite know what you're going to get. So, yeah, but where was I? I forgot now.
Yeah, it's hard to know. I mean, yeah, politics. I'll just comment on that. I mean, politics has become a game show, and I don't really care for game shows that much anyway, so yeah, I don't care too much about politics. I mean, I do, as I understand them to be pop or important, but they're also, again, another distraction, at least as they're presented to us, the masses, the plebs, as we're supposed to interpret things. So, you know, you got to cut through the weeds and try to figure out what's actually going on. And but, you know, I mean, we know plenty about that, so we won't get too much into that now.
Yeah, I got you.
Yeah.
But, okay, so let's just kick the ball down the road a little more. Did you happen to see the new Matrix movie, by the way?
Yes, I did. Yes.
Okay. I'm looking forward to doing a detailed breakdown on this thing with somebody soon. I'm not asking you to do it. Yeah. I could. We could have fun, for sure. Mm-hmm. But I really want to take a real intense time, probably more than you want to invest, into really breaking this thing down. Yeah. Because it's a weird phenomena that has become – see, and here's another example. Something that was sort of a pop culture thing wound up influencing subcultures of all sorts. I mean, the truther community, who has not used the concept of the pill one way or another? Morpheus, welcome to the unreal, or, you know, welcome to the desert of the real. This kind of stuff, I mean – They've gone all over the map. I have to be red-pilled, red. Why are you taking a pill in the first place, I keep asking? And what about if there's other colors in that pill box? You know, okay, but either way, you know, there's a lot to it where, again, there's a cyclical, multi-layered relationship between pop culture and what's actually happening in real time as far as what's accessible to the public with the tech. And then there's yet other levels to it. You know, and this gets into some, again, practical matters. Like I give you the, for instance, with my eyesight, right? There's no surgery to correct my eyesight at all. There's, you know, different things that have come up, you know, that other people, they can get laser surgery now, this kind of stuff. You know what I found, like, just only really a couple of weeks ago and haven't gotten a chance to talk to you about, is that they now have this thing. They talked about doing the implanting and actually, like, you know, connecting a camera to the brain and all these things they've tried to do to allow people that are blind to be able to see. They've now come up with this oddly interactive technology, which is dependent upon a bunch of other things, where effectively, even if your eyes don't work well, they can either give you an audio that describes everything in front of you and feed it to you. And it's just, again, through the facility of a pair of glasses, so to speak, literally gives you information, distance, size, height, all these weird things can be fed into you, you know, in an audio. And it's an interesting thing. It's not that big. It's pretty small. And it's like the ID stuff, you know, literally it'll identify a person, by the way. If you become familiar, it'll tell you this person that it, you know, identifies with the facial recognition. Yeah. It'll tell you this person is this far away from you. And stuff like this, which is an interesting kind of, aid for the blind or the limited visually. So obviously personally interests me, but it's fascinating that this thing is actually now being made available for retail sale. And yet, you know, again, like I said, they still can't actually literally give me an eye transplant from somebody else. That won't work. Not for me. And they actually don't have the ability still to do a full eye transplant, but they're coming up with ways to maybe integrate technology into the equation for your senses. And I know this is being done on other levels, you know, being able to make things so you can hear. You know that Google Glass technology, which gives you overlays where you can read things? Well, imagine this. Through audio cues, they can create something where you sort of have closed captioning, but it's just on the inside of your glasses. And it tells you what people are saying and the sounds you're hearing. It'll identify sounds. So they've actually done this technology for a couple of different problems with the senses. And eventually, I'm thinking to myself, there may be a way to, just here, we'll give you an implant. It'll do it for you. Instead of you having to wear the glasses, you've got something that just basically tells you in your ear canal what's going on. So visually, you have a voice that you'll get used to hearing that tells you, you know, look, the table is 10 feet away. Your mother is sitting there. You know what I'm saying? And yeah. Some people will have different reactions to this kind of thing. Have you seen any of this stuff lately?
No, that's all very interesting. And I just get the feeling that as that sort of stuff develops, you're saying that it'll be like the chip or whatever, the implant will give you an auditory response within your, it'll make you hear things.
Well, eventually, I think that's what they're trying to get to. Right now, it's literally like put an earbud in and we'll tell you what's around you, in front of you, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah, I could. I mean, obviously, it could be done that, like, one of those implants could do the same thing that your brain does when it's interpreting sound. So it would just do that, and it would be just like you're hearing something. But I think there will also be these sort of difficult to explain and difficult to. I think it'll be difficult to interpret for the people that, like, use these sorts of things, for people who don't, because I think there'll be like. You could maybe call it even a sixth sense, where these implants or these technologies will, yes, feed this information directly to your brain, but the thing it's transmitting isn't necessarily like a copy of, audio cognition, like that you get same thing from your ear. It's like this other thing that's got this weird, different sort of beyond what we know of in standard the five senses. I'm thinking about the canon instead of the five senses as we know them. It'll be like something else that I think it could probably just derive. I think this will be like the result of experimentation. They'll be able to find like these weird input output things with the brain and these technologies that are going to be bizarre. But I think that kind of gets into interesting territory with again the idea of a sixth sense. But also that one thing that I've seen over the years, you see, I've seen all sorts of different. Themes. You see the same themes and different concepts popping up again and again. And one of them that you see, especially like with these implants and stuff, is the concept of telepathy. Mm-hmm. And I know Kevin Warwick was like kind of saying when he did those implants on himself, he was kind of referencing the idea of like, well, you know, what would be really cool is if we made these implants that would allow us to communicate telepathically via this technology, where we're not talking, we're not communicating, so making no sound. However, we are communicating with one another, mind to mind, with the aid of these implant technologies. And so that kind of gets at the same thing, too. I could see how that would...
It almost seems strange that that doesn't already exist, because the concept of wireless communication is not a problem. So if you can just figure out a way to take, you know, again, let's go back to the technology I was talking about. That exists already, but they're doing the testing and refining it just the same way. Like, where did this come from? Somebody might say, well, the step before this was probably point your camera at something and it tells you what it is. It identifies it.
Yeah.
Right. So if you just connect these things together, there's no reason for you not to be able to see what I see, hear what I hear. And if we can make the wireless connection, then why is it that technology does not produce telepathy already? It seems like all the pieces are actually there. Just somebody needs to assemble them and make them small enough. Or am I crazy?
No, I don't think so. And this is another thing to get back to, I don't know, conspiracy culture. One of the things that I found most fascinating about the Georgia Guidestones, you haven't heard of that one in a few years, have you? But on there, one of the things, there was a book that accompanied the Guidestones. So there's like the 10 guides for, you know, this new age, this idea. A lot of it is about how we need to depopulate the world to curb the environmental catastrophe that was what created by technology. But anyway, if you read the book that corresponds to the Guidestones, it's really, really fascinating. It's and the stuff that's in there, what one of the things they talk about in that book, and this is the people who funded and had these Guidestones made, who is a shadowy, secretive group of some secret society or group that didn't want to be known publicly. Yeah, but
the credit is not exactly clear. And the weird thing is, I don't know if you know about this, but I've gotten pictures over the past, I'd say, year from people, because they're not too far from me, the Guidestones.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, and I've gotten pictures from people who are, like, going there and saying, why are they covering up part of it? So there are images out on the internet. If you find them, people have tried to share them, and they haven't really gone viral or anything. But they have, like, literally put covers over part of what's written on the Guidestones now.
Really?
And nobody knows what the reason is. Again, trying to figure out exactly which organization. I mean, there's an organization on the books that is responsible for the land and maintenance of this thing. But is it actually the people? That's another question.
Yeah.
But they're covering up parts of the Guidestones. I was wondering if you knew about
that. No, I didn't hear about that. That's fascinating. But there was a granite company that was contracted by this one guy who came to the office, and they're the ones that published this book. It was this granite company that built them. Sure. But I believe the book says that they're making this booklet at the behest of the same guy who had them made. And it gets into the esoteric, to be sure, and it definitely mentions, like, in the future, we will have machine-human interfaces that will enable synthetic telepathy. Mm-hmm. So, and this is the Georgia Guidestones, which you wouldn't necessarily think really have that much to do with technology and transhumanism. But if you read the book, it's almost like that's, like, the central theme of it. The Guidestones themselves don't overtly say that. You have to, like, read this weird thing that the creators wanted to say about what their reasons for building this thing. Mm-hmm. But that's fascinating. They're covering up part of it. That whole story has always fascinated me, the Georgia Guidestones. It's a good one.
Well, it's always weird, and there's also rumors that the dismantling of them is about to come soon, too, for some reason or other. These things are loaded with all sorts of rumor and innuendo, especially when you start talking about it has to do with, especially those that are in Georgia, you know. Whoops, there we go. Are you still there?
Yeah. You're cutting in and out, but you're there clear.
Yes,
now. Yeah. I mean, there's a few things on the Guidestones that I think people could take as offensive, and perhaps they're starting to cover it up in before the fact, before they get, like, even a bigger reaction than they have previously. It's like, well, we don't, you know, some of the things we said there, it could be taken by people, and again, there could maybe be a reactionary revolt against this that's just completely counterintuitive to what we, the creators of these things, even want in the first place. So maybe it's more trouble than it's worth. And, I mean, they were famously defaced a couple years back, and that was a big to-do. And, you know, it said, like, no new world order and things like that. And so that's pretty fascinating. I'm going to have to keep my eye on that one.
Yeah, well, look, it's a weird thing when you look at the history of secret societies, again, in Georgia alone. You know, there was a cult that literally spurred the growth of the Ku Klux Klan in Warner Robins in Georgia. You know, they're they are linked to the Pentecostal church and all this other stuff. There's a whole weird nexus of that. There's a very intense culture here, you know, having revolving around the Freemasons, but I mean, you know, it's one of those things that's pretty intense. Like, we're different here. You actually hear the exchanges, sometimes in places between people publicly where they want you to know, you know, you ask for a favor, they tell you no. Somebody says, well, you know, do you have a favor to offer for a widow's son?
Oh,
which
God.
Is sort of a code word. I mean, and people openly do this stuff here, which is strange because I never saw it in, you know, most of the places I've lived in the U.S. I never saw it like this.
Mm. Yeah, that is very – I've never seen anybody actually say that. I've heard of it, but I haven't actually seen that. That's fascinating that you have, yeah.
Yeah, well, I've seen that in, you know, the oddest of places. I mean, there's a vitamin shop.
Yeah, I was thinking 7-Eleven when you're saying that.
You would think so, but no, it, like weird places, though, and like people are communicating like this, and there are people that, you know, have gotten you know, extreme problems over, you know, the Freemasons Bible, which is a different looking book, maybe not being returned after somebody died, this kind of thing. I'm just saying I've seen all these kind of weird things.
Yeah.
Firsthand here more than I did. And I used to live, again, right down the street from a pretty large lodge in Jersey, even at one point. You know, and I saw these guys and they were mostly just, you know, businessmen looking to network and help each other out.
Exactly. Yeah. I was thinking about that very aspect of Freemasonry today, Chuck, of that, like, I think the good analogy for it is like, and the ideal, I think, for Freemasonry is that it's kind of like the gifted program at a school. And that the Freemasons are trying to find the best and brightest throughout, you know, local society. They initiate them into the lodge so that they may be put to the task of doing the great work, right? And the great work on the microcosmic scale is like, hey, let's make our community better. Correct. So that's the idea. But I think in reality, it's just degenerated into, well, yeah, that's the ideal, but... you know, it's a good way to make business contacts. It's a really good networking tool. So instead of getting the best and brightest, it's just you've more likely gotten these people that are savvy enough to understand that it's a good networking tool, use it for business, and forget all that enlightenment mumbo jumbo. And who really cares about like making the world a better place? You can, in fact, you can pretend you're making the world a better place by like starting up your own business and becoming very successful in doing so. And, you know, you're creating jobs and you're making America, America. And so you can actually argue the fact like, hey, look, I'm making the world a better place, but it's just this like generic commercialized version of it where the ideal has been lost. And I think that's what's happened there is I think that's, that, I don't know. That's just the thought I was having today, and I thought that was interesting.
No, absolutely. And look, by contrast, I just want to point out that if you ever tune into the Uncle Show, you don't get this. You get something entirely different, which the reason why I'm going to bridge it, watch my segue, ready? The reason why I'm going to bring this up is because you go into the Uncle Show broadcast or podcast, and what you get is a glimpse into the world of Uncle. It's his world for his hour, which is entirely different. Now, here's a guy who is, you know, a bit special, and I do mean that in a couple of different ways. You know, he's a bit handicapped, and he sees the world the way he sees it. He is a literal Knight of Columbus.
Yes, yes.
But does not, you know, acknowledge. He just sees it as the... you know, nice organization. It's the Cub Scouts for grown-ups kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, very much.
And, no, it's cool, whatever. And look, he talks about things that I would never bother with, like football and stuff like that. Just whatever's on his mind and his world. So it's a thing of beauty, man. What can I say? I have no way of explaining Uncle, and I often get people who, you know, tune over to the network and they want to hear about, you know, exopolitics and esoteric things, or, you know, or deep conspiracies, historical revision. They, you know, they might want to hear about transhumanism, the influences of culture creation, etc. They tune over, they get Uncle, and they go, what the hell? Every time, like, what are you doing? And I'm like, this is his world, his time. That's all I can tell you. And if you don't get into it, you don't. But if you do, it's pretty cool, and I appreciate it. So, then they give it a second chance, and some people will come back to me and say, man, you know what? I didn't get it at first. And honestly, Aaron, if you remember when you and I first started talking, I said, I don't get this uncle thing. I didn't get it at first. I had to go back and listen again. I mean, I thought some of it was funny, which is the key point here, is that Uncle feels as though his show is definitely the comedy hour. And just through the force of his personality, without necessarily telling jokes, I think anybody who is especially stressed by the world around them can get into the sense of humor that goes on during the Uncle hour. So is that a fair summation, Aaron, or did I do it some injustice here?
No, that's great, Chuck. And yeah, it's a great, fun time. You really understand what's going on with the show, so that's awesome. I love having you as a producer. And you and I both know that we could leverage a lot of like sentimentality and just like cornball stuff that the mainstream media does all the time. It makes me want to puke. But we don't do that. And I'm not about to. We could do that all day with the show, and I'll bet we could probably like make it a lot more popular if we did that, to be honest. But I can't bear to do that, and I like making it a weird sort of, again, sometimes it's a trial by fire for people, and like it's always like this surprise. It's kind of like a Jack in the Box. It's like, here, open this thing up. I like it being that, you know. I want to keep it as that. Yeah.
This gets to why I called you a performance artist also. And you're somebody who appreciates performance art but has also partaken of it in a couple of different ways. Sometimes serious, sometimes not. You used to have this odd TV thing you did.
Oh, yeah.
Cable Access, which I was blessed with a DVD copy. And I got to tell you, it's really entertaining. So it's a well-rounded experience when you're dealing with Aaron Franz. How about that? And if you go to theageoftransitions.com, that's all one word, you can begin to explore the work. You can support the shows altogether. Uncle has a T-shirt over there. So does The Age of Transitions. And there's Ocelli.com T-shirts over there, which I don't handle at all. Aaron does. But he has decided, not because I asked him to, but he decided to, because I just told him, go ahead and use the logo, and if you can make a T-shirt, great. You know, if you buy one of those, it actually goes to help support me and the network. So that's and that is a point I like to make, is that I didn't say, okay, Aaron, I demand of you that you. No, I never did that. It's been a real serious pleasure to work with you and Uncle over the past few years, but unfortunately this hour's gone. And I got to tell you, I miss having you on my show where, you know, look, I'm not meant to be in the background and just, you know, pop up as I feel like I'm a character, by the way. On Uncle's show, I'm like a character.
You like, do a good job with that, Chuck. You really do. I really appreciate what you do in that regard. I think it's great.
It's a little shift in my personality there where I'm Chuck the producer more than I am, you know, the guy who does the radio show. And it's fun. Sometimes Uncle yells at us.
Yeah, usually me, but sometimes you'll bear the brunt of it every now and again.
Mostly you. I told you, you didn't get this over here. I'm supposed to have a drink. What are you doing? Hey, you playing with the knobs? If you don't know what I'm talking about, it's okay, but I find it hilarious. Most of the time I got to turn off my microphone, even when he asks me to go on, because I'm too busy laughing at what's going on. I find it really funny, and it's great to get into some serious topics with you, but it's also great to have fun with you, and I get to do both every Friday night when The Age of Transitions begins at 10 p.m. Eastern, and Uncle the Broadcast, which becomes Uncle the Podcast, begins at 11, and we get two distinctly different hours out of that particular slot on Ocelli.com. So I give the final word to you, Aaron, because I'm going to get out of here and get on to my next guest, which is going to be, I dare say, more unusual than you, but that's kind of a tough thing to, I'm promising it. That's what's going to happen. A more unusual guest than Aaron Franz up next. The guy's name is Ricky Ray. So you're going to want to hear that, but get ready for that. Meanwhile, Aaron, your final thoughts on this hour.
Well, yeah, I'll just ditto on what you said. It's great to be back on your show. And I think We need to leverage some time, Chuck, where we do more shows together. I'd like to do maybe bonus material, and there's so much stuff I'd like to ask you about. Honestly, we could go on and on forever. So I think one of these days we just have to make a point to do that. But it's always great being here on Friday. Love doing the Age of Transitions and Uncle the Broadcast live on Archelli.com. I appreciate having you as a producer. A lot of fun tonight. And yeah, again, the website for me is theageoftransitions.com, and that's about it. It's great to be here tonight.
Look, absolutely, always fun to work with you, Aaron. And yeah, sure, guaranteed, I'll be more than happy to do any bonus material you want to do. An extremely successful run, as far as I'm concerned, with both shows, and I just have a blast doing it. So, I thank you, Aaron Franz, and you know what? I'm going to steal your tagline for this interview. And tell you guys out there, stick around for the next hour of the Ocelli Effect. Seeker, seek on.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're tuned into the Ocelli Effect.
Ocelli.com.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold. Silver. The stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to Larry-Hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at Amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Do you like history, real history, that you were never taught in schools?
Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia.
By author Mike Swanson, with new documentation never seen before. That'll open your eyes to events that led up to this.
Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia, 1945 through 1961.
Get your copy today at Amazon.com.
Why? The Vietnam War
by author Mike Swanson.
Uncle, do you remember that time when the year 2012 was going to create the apocalypse, end of the world?
Right. And I thought it would come to the end.
Did it ever end up that way?
No.
Yeah.
Like we say, the only way it would end is when he is ready for
That's
it
right.
to end. That's how it is.
So if you want the real truth about 2012, you better listen to the Ocelli.com radio network.
Radio podcast.com.
Yeah, forget John Cusack.
John Cusack
doesn't know what he's talking about.
Doesn't know what he's talking actually about. Correct.
But we here at the Ocelli Radio Network sure do.
Do you understand and understand where it's actually coming from?
Ocelli.com.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media.
Oh,
Ocelli. Second hour of the Ocelli Effect begins now at Ocelli.com. But, of course, you could be hearing this some other time, some other place via your Fondle Slab of choice, your applicable application, your podcatcher, du jour, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, it's Wednesday, and it's the second hour, but could be another time where you are. No matter what, welcome to it. So Aaron Franz was interesting in the first hour, but as I said, we're going to get a more unusual guest this hour. His name is Ricky Ray. Now, I could try and explain him. I could point to an article I read recently that he wrote, which has an interesting sort of skew, so to speak, on modern culture and music. I could point to the fact that the guy knows how to build guitars, from what I'm told, friends of mine. I could tell you that the man is aware of how secret societies work. I could tell you that he's got a really curious view of the esoteric. I could point you to Hagman's report with him some time ago, where they talked about the black nobility and all that. I could point to, I hate to do this, but could point to the Vinnie Eastwood show where he had a totally different sort of conversation. This guy's just a fascinating individual, and I don't even know entirely what to make of him myself. So I leave to the judgment of you, the listener, what it is that we're going to discuss with Ricky Ray. And I've got a curious point of entry here, because we're going to talk about culture creation and music. And who knows where it goes from there? We're not working with a script here, folks, ever. So no script. It is the revelation through conversation. And here it is. Ricky Ray, first of all, how you doing tonight, sir?
Hey, how you doing, man? Very good. Actually, just looking at the mountain and the snow out there.
Mountains and snow. Okay. Well, that could be in a lot of places. But we won't get into necessarily even where you are right now, because I'm told that that could be something that you might not want to discuss. So,
true.
You're a curious character. Let me, you know, give you the probing questions, and obviously I've done a little more of a look at you than maybe somebody else has, and maybe there have been people that haven't heard of you before. How would you introduce yourself to somebody who didn't listen to some of these other shows where you've done some rare interviews and talked about some rarefied topics? I mean, just brand new, who is Ricky Ray? And they go, well, Chuck's got him on. Why is he there? Who is he? I mean, it's kind of hard to really give you a bio in a minute or two or five or an hour. I don't know. It's kind of diverse. Can you help me out with this?
Oh, sure. I grew up out in Wyoming, way out west and all in the mountains and stuff. And but I had a famous relative, and I would spend summers with her. In the 60s, like the summers 65 through 67, and her name is Yvonne Craig, and basically she was the bat girl in the 60s.
You were saying that your relative there, what was her name again?
Her name is Yvonne Craig.
Okay, Yvonne Craig. Okay.
Yeah, and she was an actress and a dancer. And in the early 60s, she was in, like, one of the Elvis movies. But later on, in the mid-60s, she was Batgirl in the old campy Batman series. And she played the Green Marta character on Star Trek on one episode.
Okay. Okay, so I've seen her before. You know, I remember the Batgirl from the Batman series. That was was interesting. Yeah, I definitely remember her there. I look back in Star Trek. I'm sure I could figure out, you know, exactly which one she was. But anyway, so that's interesting. So she had kind of a sort of a view into Hollywood, at least as a working actress.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so anyway, I would be there as a kid out on summers and hang out with her and her girlfriend, Julie Newmar, the original Catwoman. And we would travel back and forth between the Bay Area and L.A. and all. And kind of, we went to the Monterey Pop, which was kind of a life-changing experience and all. I was 9 years old, and we'd went up to the Bay Area and hung out with a lot of people, like the famous lithographer that did a lot of litho work with bands and artwork, you know, Wilfred Satie. And we all kind of piled after the Bay Area in San Francisco down to Monterey Bay to hang out at Monterey Pop. And we had a lot of pills from Augustus Owsley and all, because his acid at that time was basically 750 mics on a buffer of methamphetamine, the German-style Pervitin that was real famous or infamous in World War II, and it looked like a little purple one-a-day vitamin.
Ah, so the stuff you're talking about there that was made famous in World War II, sort of ignored by a lot of historians, but how did the Blitzkrieg function? They were on speed.
Doped up, man. Yeah, yeah. Methamphetamine, Pervitin was one formula of it that fed the Nazi war machine, and that's how they were able to just go nonstop at real high speed, and that they called Blitzkrieg.
Mm-hmm. No, that's really curious that they were mixing that together with LSD, which,
yeah,
you know.
Owsley and Nicholas Sand kind of were partners in crime, or counterculture, if you want to look at it that way. And they created LSD that was essentially cleaner and more pure than Sandoz Laboratory where it began.
And well,
so
that
was
go ahead.
Yeah, so that was kind of the origin of that with those guys making it in the Bay Area in the 60s, you know. And then Owsley actually was the sound man for the Grateful Dead and the Kool-Aid experiments, as it were, you know. And so the girls were very hip to all this kind of stuff and would go up there to the Bay Area like we did. And then they came back to see the big Monterey Pop Festival. And, you know, this there was an occult thing about Monterey Pop where the whole West was essentially initiated in the Brave New World, or that phase of the great social experiment.
Hmm. Well, this is an interesting thing. You know, I had on the Grateful Dead's tour manager not too long ago, Hank Harrison, who also happens to be the father of Courtney Love. Did you ever encounter him?
Years and years ago in the 60s, I probably wouldn't remember some of the people. The girls definitely knew all the bands up in the Bay Area. They certainly hung out with the Darby Slick and Grace Slick of, you know, the Jefferson Airplane and stuff, and a couple of the guys out of the Quicksilver Messenger Service. But as far as the Dead and the things going on, they were a little distant from that.
Okay. Well, look, interesting, because first of all, I would say that there are some listeners to this show who might not be aware of even what the Monterey Pop Festival was, right? Which was very interesting, and even on the surface level, a mainstream music historian would talk about it for sure, because all of the artists that came together and the fact that it was in this one place. And but, you know, look, there is the artistic element when it comes to music, and there is the business, and there's yet another program in play that, you know, I think not everybody is fully aware of. Some of the listeners to this show might be, but the general population is not aware of. So, you know, how do you take that apart? And also, you know, give us a little bit of an idea about what the Monterey Pop Festival experience was like.
Okay. Well, let's break down why it even occurred in the first place.
Sure.
And what was going on there, okay? And I'll give you a picture of it, as it were. Basically, in 1967 was the very destructive 6 Days War with Israel.
Okay.
where they recaptured Jerusalem back. You know, and there is an element of biblical prophecy to that. But there was another thing going on while that was raging, and the Israelis were up in the Golan Heights for very specific, let's say, occult reasons to recapture Mount Hermon.
Okay.
So anyway, there was a spy ship called the USS Liberty and everything, and they picked up the conflict over in the Golan Heights, that there was more than just the 6 days war going on, that they were also up there trying to take Mount Hermon and the Golan Heights. The Israelis basically, what they intended to do is hit the USS Liberty and kill and sink it, and blame Egypt for it, to get the U.S. involved and everything, to take out Egypt, to basically jump in there and possess the land at least until the Nile River, which is a chunk of land that they want to possess. You know, they didn't sink the Liberty, but it crawled away. It was very crippled up. Men died. Many were wounded. And you can look online about the USS Liberty and see where it was attacked on June the 8th.
Right. Okay? We covered this extensively, just so you know, Ricky. We covered this extensively, and I don't know if you ever read the book called Blood in the Water about the attack on the Liberty. But we definitely devoted hours of discussing just that event on this show, just so you know. So listeners would be familiar with the circumstances and some of what went on as far as the, you know, the experiences of the men on board and the covered up incident that is the attack on the USS Liberty. But let's put that in context now. Why is that? I mean, because we started talking about Monterey Pop, and now we're on to this. You're going to connect this together for us, aren't you?
Correct. Okay. What happened was U.S. and world media was looking at the 6 days war conflict and the USS Liberty, and it was making a lot of news. So basically, to distract people, then the people running the great social experiment had a crisis on their hands that they needed to fix, like right now. And so they basically contacted a man who was, you know, an operative for agencies in the great social experiment, John Phillips of the Mamas and Papas, and told him to speed up this great concert that they had planned for 1967 and the whole psychedelic movement, because in the great social experiment, you had essentially the Beatles, then moving to psychedelia with the Mods, and then you had the psychedelic movement starting in 67 with one famous Beatles album, Sgt. Pepper's, of course, to kick that off in essence. And all, and at the same time, the Rolling Stones did their dark version, their Satanic Majesty's Request, right at the same time, so that people could pick and choose. It was kind of like good cops, bad cops, as far as these bands and going psychedelic in 67. But they had to speed up the big concert, you know. So John Phillips and other people out there sped things up so that the Monterey Pop Festival came immediately, so that all eyes on media were on this big counterculture event with hippies and stuff. And they had already kind of created hippies to discredit the anti-war movement, you know, because conservative America didn't like the image of the dirty hippie, you know. So they sped up the great social experiment after the USS Liberty. And so on the second week or so in June, they had 3 days and set up the Monterey Pop Festival and brought in acts that had been MK'd from England, as well as acts in America out of the Bay Area, and the MK Ultra things going on up in the Bay Area and from Laurel Canyon. and all created bands down in L.A. and all. And Monterey Bay was a meeting point halfway for both San Francisco Bay bands and the L.A. bands to meet and all, and then bringing over the English acts like The Who, Jimi Hendrix at that point and all. And basically they even bussed in like 200,000 kids out of Canada for this big, giant free concert lasting 3 days.
Right.
And all. And this was basically an initiation of that generation into Aldous and Julian Huxley's Brave New World. Yeah. And all. Where the people like their slavery and all with the unholy trinity of sex, drugs, rock and roll. And the soma that was feeding it was LSD and all. And, you know, Sandoz Laboratories, it was a little hard to get, but, you know, for Monterey Pop, a lot of Sandoz LSD hit the Bay Area, and it was illegal in 66. So it got in to America to make it to Monterey Bay as an emergency item to draw public attention to Monterey Pop instead of the disaster with the USS Liberty, which was on June 8th in 67.
Right. Are you familiar at all with Dave McGowan's work?
The late Dave McGowan, yeah. Essentially, you know, he was trying to explain the 60s and the counterculture actually to his kids. And right. That was what actually spurred him to research and everything. And, you know, he grew up all around that going on in L.A. and Laurel Canyon. And so he just, as a researcher, he just went in back in time to where he was growing up and began digging. And, you know, he wrote on his website, which is still up. His family has kept it up. You'll find articles that lead to all the weird that was going on with the Laurel Canyon.
Right. Now, just a quick other question here is that, geez, you know what? I'm having a little trouble with my microphone here. Hold on a second. Anyway, there we go. No, my microphone was giving me trouble there. Sorry. But anyhow, the odd question here, because I'm looking back at the list of people that appeared at that that first Monterey Pop Festival, right? And there's some people that don't appear to fit in the groove that you're laying here. So I wonder if you could explain why it is we got Otis Redding, you know, who doesn't seem to fit exactly with the psychedelic aspects here. Some people would say the Beach Boys do fit in. Some people would say they don't. You know, but Lou Rawls is supposed to be there. Eric Burdon is an obvious. I mean, you know, when you get into the Jefferson Airplane and all this, I mean, it's like, yeah, of course. This has got to be who's got to show up during this 3 days. But, I mean, there's some odds mixed in there, too. Is that just, you know, part of the, well, we'll just bring together all the biggest acts we can to draw the most attention? Or is there some other thing in play here that I need to understand?
Well, the big labels are tied to all these things going on with the Great Social Experiment and all. And they enlisted a variety of different acts to come in and fill in very quickly. You know, the Monterey Pop started the 16th, 17th, and 18th running and all. But that was as fast as Phillips and the crew could basically pull this whole thing together and all. So they kind of had to grab a hodgepodge of acts and everything that were seem a little unrelated, but they all actually kind of were with the 60s counterculture and stuff. I mean, it's like when you look at Roland and Martin's Laughing and old reruns of it, and they got their hair and they got people like, you know, Sammy Davis Jr. or Frank Sinatra, but they've all grown their hair out a little bit and they're using, you know, 60s chatter and all to be really groovy, you know, and all. And this was just part of the whole thing. So these bands were quickly called in, every act that they could summon and everything to draw global attention of media off of the USS Liberty on June 8th, you know, and as fast as they could get that thing together at the Monterey County Fairgrounds, bingo, they went through 16th, 17th, and 18th, running day and night. And, you know, they even bussed in a lot of people, and they brought in Sandoz Laboratories acid to flood the Bay Area, as well as stuff coming down from the San Francisco Bay Area, courtesy of Owsley and Nicholas Sand. Nicholas Sand is the guy who invented orange sunshine, just so you know about acid.
Okay. Okay, no, I'm following all this. And so somebody who is not familiar with these things would then have to ask a lot of questions to get to where I'm going to go right now, which is very simple. And look, I'm just going to give you the cue and let you run with it, because this is where we need to kind of explain about the Tavistock Institute, and we need to explain about the creation of the – because, look, you gave people the surface view, right? Go ahead. Go look at the Monterey Pop. See how it is. See what it is. Okay, it's this cultural event, but is it organic? And, yeah, so now – tell me how this was engineered, via the things that I just mentioned. I mean, in part, we could also bring up the American CIA, the MI5-6, whatever agencies over there, et cetera, et cetera.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, let's go back where the great social experiment began in the 60s, okay?
Sure.
You know, people like the Beatles and the Stones and everything, really we have to go back to 59 and everything. 59 was kind of a time when rock and roll in America and England died. Mm. You know, pioneers in rock were in, like Chuck Berry, were in prison for tax evasion, and Elvis was in the military. And then we had three rock stars in 59 that died in a terrible plane crash, the Big Bopper, Ritchie Valens, and Buddy Holly.
Right.
So a lot of people think with, you know, Don McLean's song, American Pie, that the day the music died was when those three guys died in 59, you know. But essentially what they did was they replaced it with doo-wop music, as far as on pop radio and AM radio. And in England, Eddie Cochran and some English early rockers died too, and they replaced it with Mercy Beat, you know, which was kind of their thing, like doo-wop running for a few years. But while that was going on, they were planning the great social experiment, which really part of it started all post-World War II. You know, after World War II, out of the chaos that they manufactured came the order. And all, and so the New World Order started after World War II, and Hollywood wasn't going to get rid of the old OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, that became the CIA, and which caused a lot of old Hollywood heads to basically retire at the end of World War II, because the CIA that it became was not going to leave Hollywood like they hoped.
Well, it's interesting because the OSS is not the only organization that wound up being consumed by the CIA. There was actually multiple intelligence agencies that were sort of just, well, again, I only can use the term consumed by what would become the CIA, which, again, on paper, it was one thing, but in reality, it was another. See, and that's the fascinating thing about this, like this doo-wop sort of thing that happened with music, where I don't think it really grabbed young people's attention. So a lot of people. It just wasn't working. Sha-na-na was not going to work, even though they exist, you know, for young people.
Frankie Avalon and Annette Funicello out of Disney weren't going to fill the gap doing doo-wop either, man. Or no. Pat Boone, you know, that went on to be a real ministerial Christian fraud.
Mm-hmm. No, exactly. You know? So what you had to do now is construct something that, you know, and some people say that after the Kennedy assassination even, this is really when they flushed it all, because this is when the British invasion comes in. Yeah, so, but in the meantime, they put the duop forward.
The death, the occult thing of the death of Kennedy was the death of divine kingship as far as him. And then the divine fool was Lee Harvey Oswald as far as the occult principle of divine kingship and all. And the death of the king is a sacrifice and all, which happened in November of 63 and all. And then and even the death of the divine fool, Lee Harvey Oswald, filled that. But that was the death of two kingship figures from an occult stance on kingship.
Right.
And all. So the door was open, and there was a flood of energy that was released with the death of Kennedy and the divine fool. And also in 64, then comes the buildup of the counterculture, and they take bands that had come back during, see, in the doo-wop era, English bands weren't getting gigs, so they would go over to Germany in Hamburg and play in the Reeperbahn, the red light district, see? And that's where the Beatles actually cut their chops, the Stones, and a number of British bands that were all part of the British invasion during the Mercy Beat years were over there cutting their chops in the red light district,
right.
You know? So it was going on, and when they came back, they were snatched up. They were molded by the Tavistock Institute and, you know, got their little dose of mind control and stuff. They were groomed, you know, wearing, you know, suits. And basically the whole look of the suits and the whole thing, that came from the 1960s counterculture movie that paved the way for the look and all by Federico Fellini in 1960, La Dolce Vita. You see, rock and roll didn't die on the European continent like it did in England with the death of rockers, or America with, you know, rockers in the joint or in the military like Elvis or that plane wreck that killed the three guys. So Europe still had rock and roll going on, and La Dolce Vita was about, you know, a decadent hedonistic lifestyle, which was part of it. And if you look at the rock bands and everything, they're wearing little black suits and skinny ties exactly like the Beatles and the early Stones. That's where the look came from, man.
Right. And you look, there's a legitimate, but see, there's a legitimate beginning to these bands, right? Where they are seeking to emulate something. And in fact, the British bands were emulating American music, and doing it their own way. And this is an honest and organic cultural exchange. And that's one thing that a lot of guys who talk about what you're talking about right now ignore. There is an honest beginning to it. It doesn't mean that the second that somebody, I mean, I'm not saying you do this. I'm saying some people do. And the thing is, there's an honest beginning, and then what happens? They figure out a way to weaponize it. And that's the proper term here, I think, is they weaponize the organic culture. I mean, unless you think I'm wrong, go ahead.
Well, in essence, when they use Mercy Beat, you know, to fill in the gap of the death of rock, and then America used doo-wop for a few years to fill this empty spot, that left a lot of unsatisfied listeners that that they'd lost the magic of the 50s, you know, and they had this kind of spongy saccharine music playing, and that was cool because that boredom piqued people's interest in the manufactured Beatles. I mean, a lot of English bands that were up and coming idolized the 50s, but they couldn't get gigs playing that in England and went over on the continent playing there in the red light district in Hamburg and all. And, you know, you can look it up and see all these bands that cut their chops there. So when they came back to England, they were grabbed up by, you know, record labels like EMI that were front for MI5. and everything. In fact, Carnaby Street and the fashions that emerged were a front for MI5 behind the scenes there, if you really want to get down and dirty with what was really going on. And they basically took the imagery out of La Dolce Vita to dress the bands up that way and everything. And so they got the nice clean image, but they had the Stones in suits, but looking a little dirty and grungy. So it was kind of like good cop, bad cop. And you could pick one or the other. And they started with those two and then manufactured them and put them out there. You know, they'd been around, but didn't catch on. There in 64, when Ed Sullivan brought them over to America, I mean, they even manufactured their Coming to America, you know, bringing busloads of girls and young people down when they came to manufacture their arrival stateside.
Well, and it's interesting. So, it's interesting to me that a lot of people cover this, right? And don't recognize it past the 60s, because in the 70s, it was redone again in another way when they, you take a look at who really controlled the Sex Pistols at a certain point. You take a look at who really had control over the music business and what they had to reload again. That lull that came in the 1950s that you're talking about happens again in the 70s.
And you got the rise of technology by the mid-70s, and they're going from short AM top 40 to longer sets with the birth of binaural FM radio right at that time, and that's the end of Vietnam. The draft is over on one side, and we got all these people that graduated as plastic activists out of the 60s, and they can work for the man now and wear polyester bell bottoms and stack shoes. But now they're turning pop and rock acts and everything over on the big label side to play, you know, FM radio fare and songs and stuff. So the whole imagery and the music and that generation graduating, now working for the man, you know, with binaural FM replacing AM by 75, and all, now they need some place to go. So they pulled the whole concept of disco out of the gay community and the bathhouse subculture.
Right.
You know, and like that little song about YMCA, that's about bathhouses and gay meeting points in the gay culture. But disco came out of the gay bathhouse subculture. That was the music that they were getting off on, you know, and this thing blew up. You know, Saturday Night Fever, if you sit down with some gay people from that era, they will decode all the gay symbols all over Saturday Night Fever.
Right.
You know?
Well, but see, so,
and all of this was part of that, what you just said, that second wave of social engineering going from activism to hedonism in the 70s.
Right.
On, and remanufacturing it.
Well, see, this is how we have to, and we have to progress into the 1980s, because there is a lull there where the culture embraced the disco thing for a moment, but it didn't last.
Big time.
So.
No, and that was part of it, because they were going past the liberal, prosperous Carter years into the whole neocon era. And of course, they needed a manufactured opposition, or they controlled opposition. And also, the very month that Reagan signed the Tax Act in August of 81, magically, MTV appeared as controlled opposition to Reaganomics and neocons that were birthed during the Reagan-Bush era. This is a social engineering side of it that was going on from the 60s, from activism into hedonism of the 70s, binaural FM circa 75. So now it's audio visual with MTV as controlled opposition to the birth of neocons and Reaganomics at that time.
Right. Well, see, but you know, this is the mark of progression.
It was an initiating act was at Monterey Pop, and they had pulled all these bands to fill in very quickly. So all media attention was on Monterey Pop. And believe me, if you lived back then when that was going on, around the clock, every news show and other TV programs were making space just to show Monterey Pop, for some reason interrupting regular programming like Gunsmoke or something. You know what I'm saying? And also this was a real big thing, but to draw attention off of that little accident with the USS Liberty.
Right. Now, it's interesting to note that they still, even though they didn't have to distract us from the Liberty in 1985, because here I'm a teenager in 1985. I went to a little event called Live Aid, which, you know what, seems to me like the 1980s version of Monterey Pop, because here it was, they brought together everybody they could think of and brought it to a world stage under a good cause and all that stuff. And it was, you know, I lived in New Jersey, so it was not too far to get to Philly.
Oh, there you go. Yeah,
you know,
John Mellencamp and another big label puppet like John Cougar Mellencamp leading all this crazy stuff for Farm Aid and everything. But at the same time, farms were getting aid and kind of dying out, and the government was trying to steal their land with multi-generational farmers and everything, then, yeah, it was all manufactured with Farm Aid. Absolutely, man.
Well, see, but now just by going to the concert, you were supposed to be participating in this, you know, helpful thing for either the farmers or the starving kids in Africa or whatever, right? So it was this big thing. And, again, it starts with the initiation from England, because they had this thing you know, where they got together, Band-Aid, remember? And it was, you know, do they know it's Christmas time? And it was this song that was just, you know, universally accepted all over the place. And then there was, you know, it was just like a new sort of activism, but it was in the modern age. And it didn't...
Well, it was a real plastic activism, which also had an origin with the counterculture and all, and the push on the counterculture and the whole dirty hippie image really turned off a lot of conservative Americans to the anti-war movement in Vietnam, and that was deliberate out of the 60s.
Right.
See?
So
there's always other agendas behind things like that when it goes on. And Farm Aid was, you know, very convenient thing, you know, and pushed on MTV very visually, because now music can become visual with MTV and everything. And so for artists, even to this day, if you don't have a video for music that you're doing, you're screwed.
Right, right. You know, which is odd, because, again, I lived at that time, and I remember MTV was this weird thing that for some older kids – It was very hypnotic. It was like they would just stare at the same stupid music videos all day long. And I'm not saying I didn't watch it as a kid. I did, but I noticed that it had an effect on some people that was, you know, just you could just watch it happening while they were staring at the TV.
Yeah. Yeah, they cloned off a whole generation using neuro-linguistic programming, timed images, repeated things and images and stuff with a lot of subliminals. But essentially, the way they were doing it was right out of the textbook of neuro-linguistic programming. And they basically, you know, cloned off a generation from August 81 when they appeared, the same month that Reagan signed the Tax Act and began Reaganomics and everything and all. And it was controlled opposition all the way. But they programmed the young people then at all in, like, the hairstyles, the clothes they wore, in fashion, even the way they talked, using neuro-linguistic programming. And by 85, as you say, kids were very cloned all over America. And their attention was on MTV like they were addicted to it, like dope, because it was hitting those dopamine triggers in the pleasure zone from neuro-linguistic programming, you know. And Fox News uses neuro-linguistic programming exactly like MTV does, and that's how they were able to target middle America and rural America to clone people off to their bullshit. I hope that doesn't offend anybody, but that's just the way it is.
No, no, it's okay, but I mean, we got to talk about all of this because somebody might say, okay, neurolinguistic programming, that sounds a little complex. Let's break down a couple of things here. The repeated rushes on MTV were color coordinated for a reason. They used stuff.
Absolutely, man.
Like the, you know, like the space launches as part of their imagery, right? Because this was meant to represent a certain iconography. I know I don't have a lot more time with you, but I want to sort of progress throughout this to just give people a broad stroke, really, about this culture creation issue and the manipulation of the media through pop culture. So we've only gotten into the 80s, really, and you mentioned news, so we kind of jumped there, but this continued on. Was very simple.
MTV was a controlled opposition form to Reaganomics and the birth of the neocons under Reagan Bush. By 93, you know, when Clinton came in, this was now the birth of extreme left and the neoliberals going to happen after 12 years of Bush Reagan and neocons in that era. So almost immediately in 93, when Clinton came into office, you know, and all that, then on MTV, they canceled Headbangers Ball and just about every ounce of programming that was on MTV up to 93 was pretty much canceled just literally overnight. And then they turned into two MTV channels and went a whole different direction both ways with, again, social engineering of MTV. But see, they weren't enemies of neocons and everything, so they had to change the entire programming system of social engineering to go with the new neoliberal colors of the 90s.
Right, which, by the way, I was one of those kids who was sad when they, you know, I finally had gotten trapped into it because Headbangers Ball was one of my shows. I got to be honest.
Oh, yeah,
with,
man.
I liked it, and kids,
they were wearing, you know, leather and torn up jackets and everything and having big hair, you know, to look like John, and even females were trying to look like John Bon Jovi and all that and the hair bands back in the 80s. I mean, and to this day, you can look at women now, what, in their 50s, early 60s, that grew up then, and they still will wear big hair and try to look like, you know, fat versions of John Bon Jovi. Unbelievable. I mean, chicks try to look like that.
You know, that's all true, but, I mean, to be honest with you, I was actually a musician. So I was going with, you know, some of that template. And, you know, by the time 93 rolls around, I'm, 21 years old. And so I'm playing clubs and actually doing that. And by the way, just for the record, sadly, John Bon Jovi is from the same place I am. You know, I was from New Jersey. So I don't like him personally. Anyways, it's a whole thing. Anyhow, back to it. But I was a hard rock and metal musician at the time. So
I love it.
You know,
I played on sessions. I relate very well.
So, you know, I'm just saying it was like, but there was a legitimate music that I was creating and obviously didn't sell well. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this right now. I'd probably still be doing the music.
Well, you know.
But, yeah.
Listen, man, you don't get a big label contract unless you get in there and you literally sell your soul and acknowledge the enemy. Same. Because that's behind the industry. And let's face it, man, if you look in the scripture about Satan, even before he fell, he was a musician.
Mm. No, this is, yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Ezekiel 28, you know, when he's listed as a fallen cherub, and God told the prophet to take up a lamentation of great sadness and mourning for this guy that was ruling the earth and ruled behind the king of the earth at that time. And so you'll see that his story in Ezekiel 28, if you crack open a Bible, and what he was like before he fell. that he was perfect in all his ways, a beautiful creature, a musician with rhythm and melody already built into him until iniquity was found in him.
Right.
No, this is about the, you know, the before the fall. And, beauty and beauty and the ability to, you know, not only be the muse, but to produce the music, so to speak. You know, this was the thing. The power was granted, you know, when he was still part of the choir of angels. I don't remember if he was exactly a cherub. I think he was more than a
cherub. He was a cherub.
Was he?
No, okay. He's a cherub. Yep, in the angelic order, he was a cherub.
Okay.
And everything who after the seraphim with six wings were the close, very close, you know.
Right,
and
right.
All, but, you know, again, perfect in his ways. The description of him, in fact, in the description of him in Ezekiel 28, he was wearing a garment that had nine stones set in gold, and every one of those stones corresponds with the gold to the 10 Sephiroth of the Kabbalah, of the Tree of Life, or, you know, occultism out of the Kabbalah.
Well, you remember a little more about the scripture than I do, but I'm just saying it is relevant and it's interesting because, yeah, that's the truth of it. You know, there's a gangsterism in the music business for sure. But there is an esoteric to it that, you know, is worthy of exploration as well. And meanwhile, there are people that are just artists, you know, who create things.
Oh, absolutely.
But those aren't necessarily the people you get to hear from because they didn't offer themselves up to be weaponized. And as we go through the 90s, we see again, you know, a great apathy. Right. Just like we did, you know, post-Vietnam War. I mean, everybody would engage in communism, but this time they got an apathy. So I think going into the 2000s, you know, MTV was no longer the relevant thing. They had to adapt to the technology to continue to manipulate the culture.
Why by the mid 90s, you had the birth of the Internet. Hooking people up and creating a global surveillance system and all that was bigger than the Echelon that was part of the Five Eyes and, you know, the biggest surveillance system in the world. Just look up Echelon and all on Wikipedia. It'll awaken you on global surveillance.
Yeah, Echelon, the Echelon system or the proprietary Echelon system, depending on who's describing it. There is a whole thing there which everybody seems to forget about nowadays because they're voluntarily plugging themselves in now. See, it's no longer just what's being broadcast and a wide sort of spectrum. Now it's, you know, customized delivery. Right.
Well, the Internet, if you want to, you know, television was grabbed up by the Allies because the Germans had television in the 30s and used it to program their nation,
right. Literally
using imagery and sound and stuff. And the Allies grabbed that up and developed it so that by 1948, and all, then television was available to everybody and their dog in the UK, Europe, and America, and then the programming began because it took it past radio to imagery in social engineering with television. But the Internet essentially is just like interactive television where now you get to play with it and play along, which instead of being a voyeur watching television, now you get to interact with it.
Right. Yeah, no, that was my point. Meanwhile, you know, we've almost gone through a whole hour, Ricky Ray, and discussed the progression.
Sorry, guys.
No, it's okay. We've discussed the progression of nearly 60 years of what? Neuro-linguistic programming and culture creation as a weapon. And, you know,
call it social engineering.
Social engineering. Okay, look, fair enough, and this is just one of the methodologies, and as per usual, they have definitely improved and sharpened their skills as time has gone on. You know, so what are people to make of it, you know, with this history behind it? As for what it is we're looking at today, like you said, I mean, Fox uses it. Of course, it seems like every one of these broadcast networks that are allowed to persist, whether they appear to be opposition or not, you know, most mm-hmm. times controlled opposition, no real opposition is being broadcast by a corporation. That's for sure.
You know? Well, alternative news has been so infiltrated at all with technology and corruption that it's really even hard to find alternative news that's going to help a lot of people. And, you know, the shillcraft, which is like witchcraft, is all over the place on the internet now. So you really have to, so, you know, when the big doom experiment of 9/11 happened and all along with the early internet, then it just opened up floodgates of truther movement people and all, and they even knew this was going to happen. So they already had shills even in the 90s working right. for them and everything that would, you know, prophetically warn about a great big doomsday thing that was going to happen before 9/11 and everything, so that when it did happen, those shills were looked at almost prophetically mm-hmm. as, you know, prophets and whatnot. And I can name a few of those shills that people are pretty aware of in the, you know, and then the rise of the American Truther movement post 9/11, you know, started creating alternative news and putting it out, you know, and the shills were right there in the thick of it, infiltrating it and discrediting it or perverting it with disinformation. And now it's just rampant after 2011. I mean, you can measure from 2001 and 9/11 to 11 on, and the second wave of the real twisted truther movement and alternative news and stuff.
Right, which, you know, sadly, again, you know, I'm somebody who started doing this way after that, but I'm not, you know, backed by anybody. I'm doing an exploration, you know, and I get lumped in with some of these guys that I bet you could name that, you know.
Tim Poole or Jones or Mike or Rentz, Poodle Boy.
There you go.
I know these guys. I know some of them very well, you know, and what they're all about. You know, they don't like me either.
Yeah. No, sadly, you know? There are people that think that that is the alternative. And really, it's just, you know, it's just like with the movie The Matrix, where people go, look, these guys escaped out of the Matrix. And I'm like, they didn't. No, they didn't. You don't understand. They've been sent into an area. They resisted, you know, and that's the thing.
Well, the Matrix,
test 1-2.
You know, the little scene where the red pill and the blue pill, I mean, that is priceless and everything, that you can take the blue pill and party on and all and wake up believing anything you want to believe, or take the red pill and go down the rabbit hole and find out what's really going on. But the hidden side of that, even that scene, is that the blue pill is the York Rite of Freemasonry, and the red pill is the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry.
Right.
So that's really what Neo is being offered, you know, if you really want to play that.
You know, I understand, and which has always led me to the question that I've always asked about that when people really hijack that as a meme, is that, well, what about the option of, I'm not going to take a pill? How about that?
And you know, and the blue pill is Viagra anyway, so, I mean, there isn't a lot of tongue-in-cheek humor there, that somebody had a perverse sense of humor with that whole thing.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, look, Ricky Ray,
you know,
before we were, before, we're really actually supposed to be out of time, but I'm going to give you a little bit here. Yeah, we went through a whole hour. And the thing is, it's okay, but I don't know if you want to point anybody to anything. I'm going to give some links to some other discussions you've had about other topics. I would like to, in the future, go into the Black Nobility with you. That's for sure.
Very cool.
You know, and some other stuff. Yeah, and discuss maybe a little more about this topic, because again, I am a lover of music, and do appreciate creating it. But you know, on the other hand, I've also seen that it's been hijacked and weaponized, as you said, in social engineering. And I see the history, which I didn't see as a kid. You know, I didn't understand. I thought it was all organic. You know?
Well, if you, it was as organic as saccharin, brother.
No, I'm sorry. You know, but Ricky Ray, again, I really appreciate this time. And like I said, I probably should have just done the full 2 hours with you because, God, we could go in 100 different directions. Really doesn't even scratch the surface of the stuff that Ricky Ray could discuss. So we're going to have him back, guys. So anyway,
you're a pro.
I want to thank everybody for listening. And thank you, Ricky Ray, for joining us. Just hang on. I'll talk to you after I'm done here. But you guys all out there, you can remember, I'm Merely Ocelli. All of you are indeed the effect. And keep on being yourselves. Good night.